Wish that were true. So it's good to be back in Canada. I was actually born in Owen Sound, which is not that far away from here. So what I'm going to talk about today with this very amazing hockey stick is something that I called A Few Interesting Trees of the Wimp Forest. That's a metaphor, and it's taking the metaphor a little too far, but I'll explain what it means very shortly. So here's an outline. I'll start off with some introduction and motivation. This boils down to talking about gamma rays that come from wimp annihilations. This leads me to what I call the wimp forest, and then in this, like I said, overly used metaphor, the trees are actually models. I'll have two different models to talk about in a little bit of detail. One is the six-dimensional chiral square, and the other one is something called the Higgs in space, and then I'll finish up with some outlook.
By the way, what is Higgs in space, the reference to the Muppets?
Let's just say I was not unaware. The hardest part in that paper was convincing our French collaborator, making sure our French collaborator didn't find out about the reference, because she would have put a stop to that right quick. She found out afterwards. Okay. So looking at dark matter, I think this room doesn't need a whole lot of introduction to dark matter. The thing I find exciting is that dark matter has moved even out of science and into the realm of art. So here we have Cold Dark Matter, An Exploded View by Cornelia Parker. It's a very impressive sculpture. And it's time for the scientists to take dark matter back and start exploring it our way as well. And so, of course, you know, we know something about dark matter: neutral, massive, approximately stable. That still leaves everything, particle physics about it, completely undetermined. And so I want to know about that stuff too. And of course, again, this is just the motivation. We usually infer the annihilation cross-section from the relic density. We have this nice plot that at this point is quite old. It shows how, you know, three very different kinds of measurements all seem to agree on roughly how much dark matter and dark energy we have in the universe. If we think that the dark matter is a thermal relic, it tells us something about its cross-section. And that would be great, because it would mean that it has large, and by large I just mean electroweak strength, or even a little bit weaker than that, with a standard model, and that would provide us with all sorts of new avenues to detect WIMPs beyond gravitationally. So what I'm going to talk about today is about indirect detection. This is the idea that WIMPs may still be annihilating today. They produce particles that we can detect here on Earth, like photons, neutrinos, charged particles. So here's the basic idea. We've got two WIMPs coming in. They go through some kind of interaction and produce standard model states. The search for these particles is an important part of the search for the non-gravitational interactions of dark matter. It's actually particularly interesting from a number of points of view. It involves the cosmological relic WIMPs themselves, so the signals can be directly traced back to dark matter, assuming that we believe that's where they come from. And this is unlike, say, at colliders, where we may find missing energy, and it may be an exotic source of missing energy, but it may actually not be dark matter. It doesn't make a direct connection with what's out there in the universe. It offers a glimpse into some of those same annihilations that we think drove the thermal relic density, and so it would be a first step towards verifying that our hypothesis for the thermal picture of the universe is correct. And we can understand WIMP freeze-out and go back from the sort of MEV scale that that BBN tells us about back to the scale of freeze-out of WIMPs. And ultimately, together with a picture of how the WIMP interacts with a standard model, we can use this process to learn about the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy. Right? Ultimately, it can tell us about astrophysics, too. So just to remind us how indirect detection works, the rate of production is described by the cross-section for WIMPs annihilating. So that depends on the WIMP model. And then it also has the astrophysics inputs for the dark matter distribution in the galaxy. So we can sort of factor this into thinking about microphysics and to thinking about this integral of the density squared along the line of sight. It's obviously the density squared, because we need two WIMPs to annihilate. There are big simulations. Here's one example from Via Láctea 2. They provide us clues as to where to look by telling us sort of where we expect this thing to be large. And then looking at the simulation, and I didn't choose this one for any deep reason. It's just it's a pretty picture, and it does have the features that are... Well, I normalized this in an interesting way, but you're right, yes. Strictly speaking, this should have been the number density, probably.
That integral is what you measure from simulations.
To be honest, I wasn't being careful with the notation. The idea is just to sort of see how it works. But I mean, I will be more precise when I show specific things. So the center of the galaxy has the largest concentrations, but also the most ferocious backgrounds. And then we also see that there are dwarf galaxies and maybe dark subhalos, and those are other interesting targets too. And I'm going to further specify gamma rays. So now we have WIMPs annihilating and producing at least a photon in the final state. The reason I do that is that gamma rays don't get highly scattered over galactic distances, so they can point back to their source, and that gives us a handle when we use them to look for WIMP annihilations. And this is unlike charged particles, which are, of course, at the mercy of the galactic magnetic fields. Gamma rays are produced from a wide variety of Standard Model final states, so they offer some hope of reconstructing what the primary annihilations were going into. And then this is the most important one for me right at the moment. We know that the Fermi Glass satellite is up there. It's been working for about a year and a half now, and it's rapidly increasing our understanding of the gamma ray sky in an energy range from a few MeV to hundreds of GeV, and that's something that we think, you know, could very well be relevant for WIMP annihilations. So mostly my main motivation is just that there's this experiment that's going to be taking data, and you know, I'd like to understand what it's going to tell us. So I'll start off by looking at continuum gamma rays. So this is the idea that WIMPs annihilate into, say, some collection of Standard Model states. So this is taking this particle physics piece, expanding it out into a sum over what I call the perturbative final states, and then I can convolve that with the gamma ray yield from that particular final state F. There are some examples shown here. I stole this slide, actually, from a Fermi presentation. I'm not sure who they stole it from, but I bet you it wasn't done by them. You know, they have W pairs, Z pairs, and quarks, and that's because they're thinking mostly about neutralinos. In fact, I think I had to blank out the word neutralino here at the front of the image. The result to take away from this is just that the spectrum of the final ray, the final gammas that we produce are complicated and kind of smeared out. So if we have some charged states here, let's say this thing annihilates into electrons, we get gamma rays that are produced as radiation from those charged states themselves. The hadronic final states undergo corrections from the parton showering, so maybe we produce some colored state like a quark, but we know that quarks by themselves don't stay quarks. They evolve, they start spitting out gluons, they produce more quarks, and colliders, these are the famous jets. Finally, these hadronic states can either produce pi zeros, which decay, or also just radiate photons themselves. And then heavy particles, such as the W and the Z in this example, also the top quark, decay very early on. They share their energy among many final state products. Those final state products then do whatever, you know, whatever, depending on what they are, they do one of the other two things. And so they share their energy, and the energy gets smeared out. And so this is shown in this plot that I took from this paper. It shows the different curves, and it's pretty busy, but it's really not that important, all the details. The different curves show us for a WIMP of mass 1 TeV what kind of spectrum we could imagine. So this is d log of the number of photons as a function of the log of their energy. Well, as a function of their energy on a log scale. I think this is a bad label. It shows that for the different final states, what kind of spectrum of gammas we can hope to get. For leptons, we get relatively hard spectra, and that's because they have a lot of radiation of photons directly. Obviously, for the lighter electrons, these things are the hardest, and then the muons are almost the same. Taus are a little softer because they decay. For quarks, we see things are very smeared out. We pile up at very low energy gamma rays. That's because the quarks shower before they actually form pi zeros and then decay. And for the heavy particles, we produce a mixture. First of all, we share our energy the way we talked about before, and the heavy particles are just a smear of lines here. We can see that they're sort of very similar to the quark spectrum, a little bit softer because of the sharing of energy. And this is a big challenge. The signals may actually have large rates, but observing a signal is challenging. The backgrounds are complicated. They come from many different kinds of objects. The spectrum and the distribution of these objects is, I said, not always well understood. I think it's probably not ever completely well understood. So that means we don't really know what the background is. And I just said that we can have many different kinds of annihilations, which means we don't really know what the signal is either. It does have one nice feature. It has a cutoff at the mass of the WIMP. And that's because the WIMPs are colliding non-relativistically, and so they release essentially all of their mass into energy, and they don't have any spare energy on top of that. It depends entirely on where you're looking in the sky. So if you're looking at the center, and again, this is in the context of Fermi, which I happen to know the most about, I think the big things are just unresolved sources of gamma rays. So for example, pulsars, but you know, everything that produces gamma rays. And the ones they can resolve, they can take out of the analysis, but you know, they think that there are many, many, many that they cannot resolve. So this produces what looks like sort of a diffuse, you know, fuzz of gamma rays that come from the galactic center. If you look further up, then it actually gets much simpler, right, off the galactic plane, say.
But isn't it just the same problem
that produce unresolved? So yeah, and you certainly do at some level. But that's right. So there, though, you think that at least there are less of them. So however helpful that is.
But there's also less dark matter.
But there's also less dark matter. That's right, yeah. So yeah, I'm not going to really play the morphology game here. I'm going to talk about gamma ray lines, which are a feature that, you know, that I find exciting. And so, you know, the precursor to this was to mention the cutoff at the mass of the WIMP. So that is something nice. But also, I mean, it's not to say that it's easy to see. We saw that that cutoff is not necessarily very sharp. Just looking, you know, back at this plot, we see that, fine, it does cut off at the mass of the WIMP, but it really cuts off very, very slowly. So it's not a very distinguishing feature. This is just me picking on the Fermi-Glass collaboration. Most of their searches actually assume that all WIMPs annihilate into BB bar, and they don't do that because they're silly. It's motivated by supersymmetry, and they do it because it's the first thing that they're doing, and eventually they promise they'll do other things. And I'm not going to say if I believe them or not while I'm being recorded. So what I would like to talk about in more detail, I shouldn't have. It's true. what I will talk about... Sorry?
Now that you have.
Now that I... Yeah. I mean, I mentioned at lunch that my wife is the co-convener of Dark Matter and New Physics at Fermi, so... yeah. looking at gamma ray lines, we may also have spectral lines, and these occur when the WIMPs produce gammas in a two-body final state. So here's an example where the WIMPs annihilate, maybe through a loop of charged particles or something. And they produce a gamma, and the point is that it's really just a gamma and one other thing. It's not sharing the energy among many, many final state particles. Then because the WIMPs are non-relativistic, we can actually determine the energy of the gamma ray produced in terms of the mass of the WIMP and the mass of whatever the photon is recoiling against. And the line is a feature that conventional astrophysics has a lot more difficulty producing, and so maybe that can compensate for the fact that if this really is a loop process, and it probably has to be because... We think that, you know, the distinguishing feature of WIMPs is that they don't interact strongly with photons, so therefore there should be some bridge between them and the photons, and that will cut down the interaction strength by quite a bit. There are pictures, or there are models, where maybe this isn't entirely true. But so the fact that this feature sticks out may actually compensate for the fact that its rate may be smaller than the other ones, right? So maybe there are already WIMPs annihilating, maybe we're even seeing them, we don't understand how to take it out of the background, but these lines may have a smaller rate, and it may be possible to get them.
So why do you say there is no light in conventional astrophysics? I thought that's the only place that we see light, conventional astrophysics.
Well, in as much as we've never seen a WIMP, I can't disagree with you, really.
Yeah, but my point is, if you look at the spectrum of like an AGN in gamma rays,
yeah.
Doesn't it have lines?
Honestly, I didn't think so.
X-ray.
Yeah, I mean, so sure, at much lower energies, then yes, there are certainly lines.
But in gamma rays, does it have lines? Like what produces?
Yeah.
I have some very, very energetic transition.
Yeah. But I mean, but if we're asking for an energy scale of sort of TeV, it's...
I'm becoming more specific. I mean, very highly ionized iron, for example.
If you have a very sharp feature, I mean, can you just kind of search by subtracting back, measured background?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll show you the Fermi search eventually, and what they do is they actually just say, we don't really understand the background, so we're going to fit it as a smooth function, and then we're going to look for sharp features on top of it. So, it, you know, sort of a shape analysis and nothing else.
In SUSY models, do you get in some parameter space?
You do. In fact, I'm not going to talk about them in detail. But so here's my comment about supersymmetry. It's been known for a long time, actually, that these lines occur. That's not something that's new in this talk. And people have calculated the annihilation into gamma-gamma and gamma-z. So, you know, you can either have two photons or a photon and a z boson. And the same kinematics that set the line, the energy of the line in this case, you can just replace this by the mass of the neutralino. Sorry, this is the mass of the z boson. This is really bad notation, I just realized. MCHI is the mass of the neutralino. Typically, the Z line isn't going to be resolvable compared to the gamma line. And that's just because the experiments don't have the energy resolution to see them as two separate lines. And this could either be a blessing or a curse, depending on how you look at it. Since we don't have a signal, you might say, well, great, I get to add them together. And that's true. If you do see a line, though, then it'll be annoying, because it means we don't actually get to separately find information from them. So the WIMP4 just refers to the possibility that there may be a richer structure of gamma ray lines, and the fact that it's fun to use Google to find pictures of dark forests. And so what I'm going to talk about today are two theories that have interesting line structures that go beyond just the usual, you know, SUSY expectation of gamma-gamma and gamma-z. They both turn out to be extra-dimensional models, but I want to emphasize that the feature itself doesn't have anything to do with extra dimensions. It just has to do with the fact that, you know, anytime there's another particle x I can annihilate into a photon and x, then I may have a line with a particular energy. So the theories I'm going to talk about are a model of two universal extra dimensions. It's called the six-dimensional chiral square. And there's also a model that's it's a Randall-Sundrum model that has a KK neutrino dark matter candidate, and that leads to annihilation in a gamma ray and a Higgs. They do. They do many gamma ray searches. And I can try to tell you a little bit. I mean, I'm not a collaborator, but I can tell you what I know sort of afterwards, if you like. They have a number of searches for dark matter, and many of them are based on spectroscopy.
And they do see lines.
They don't see lines yet.
Sorry, those models were picked for any particular reason?
Because they have an interesting structure of lines. Yeah.
Not that they have the biggest signal.
No, not necessarily. All right, so talking about the chiral square, I'll say a little bit now about the model of the chiral square. So the starting point is universal extra dimensions, or UED. The idea behind UED is that all the fields are treated democratically. They live equally in all of the dimensions. And we're going to add to that to the usual four large dimensions with some small compact dimensions as well. So the zero mode fields are identified with the standard model particles. And therefore, every standard model particle has a Kaluza-Klein tower associated with it when we expand in the box. That is the extra dimension. And this is particularly interesting for a theory of dark matter, because the fact that everything's treated democratically means that there's a translational invariance along the extra-dimensional direction. This leads naively to a conserved quantity, the momentum, which is the KK number and the KK decomposition in the extra dimension, and therefore a stable state. So this is a way for extra dimensions to have a dark matter candidate in the first place. I said it was naive, and that's because the fact that the space is compact does change the picture slightly. It breaks the conservation of Kaluza-Klein number down to a parity, but the parity is still good enough to ensure that the lightest particle is stable. So the reason to talk about UED is just because if I want dark matter, it's sort of the most natural extra-dimensional theory, at least, that has a dark matter candidate. And it helps you with precision electroweak, and yeah, that's right.
I don't understand how you break momentum conservation in extra dimension. If it's periodic, then...
That's right. So if let's say my extra dimension was, let's say there was one and it was a circle, right? Then there would be an exact conserved momentum going around it. But the need to get chiral fermions means that it can't actually be a circle. I've got to actually fold the circle over into an orbital fold. I get a line segment. Now I've got the endpoints, and the endpoints are special. They're not really special, but they're a little bit special. And so they break this KK number conservation down to a parity.
So this is just for
That's right. But remember that I want that it, so it, but if I just put some of the standard model and not all of it into the extra dimension, that I won't have, then the fields that live, say, on the brain or on the boundary, they won't conserve KK number, and therefore the WIMP will probably just decay into those fields. So that's why you really want everything to live in the extra dimension, and then once the fermions are there, I need them to be chiral, and so it kind of goes from there. So the theory in particular I want to talk about is the chiral square, which is a square. It's a UED theory with two extra dimensions. It was considered by these authors. The way that the theory is compactified is, again, into a square. So I've written down the two extra dimensional components here as Y1 and Y2. And the adjacent sides are identified with each other. So this is different than the sort of the torus that we're sort of more used to talking about. So you can imagine understanding this space by, you know, taking your extra-dimensional space, the little square, folding it along the diagonal so that the two edges meet. And now we see, in fact, that that these two edges are the same and these two edges are the same. I pointed out that this looks to me something like an American football, but none of these authors were American and were Canadian, and they didn't appreciate it. But it's a football-shaped extra dimension if you want it, American football shape. So it has chiral fermions, so its low-energy physics can be engineered to match the standard model. It also has three fixed points where boundary terms can live that preserve KK parity, but which violate the KK momentum conservation. So if we trace back, the subtle point that made momentum not conserved was the fact that there are these points where the physics can be slightly different than the physics in the bulk, and in fact, generally, loops will generate terms that live at these points, and these are the terms that preserve KK parity but break Kaluza-Klein number conservation. No, the diagonal is just to understand how the shape is glued together, yeah. If I want to understand this as an orbifold, I should turn it into four copies, and then I can treat it as a torus, and okay. So I'm going to assume that these terms that live on the boundaries are there, because they have to be there, but that they're generated by loops, so that they're somewhat smaller, and that means that the bulk of the physics is determined by the physics of the bulk, by the terms that actually live, you know, in the entire space. There are probably theorems that I don't know them. But what I would do it, I mean, I do it the stupid way, is I do the Kaluza-Klein decomposition and I see if I can actually project them out.
Well,
so I'll write down the Dirac equation in n dimensions. Right, take out the large components, and then look to see whether I can get rid of either the left or the right-handed half of the four-component fermion, or actually maybe more-component fermion that's left. I'm being a little disingenuous when I say it that way. You need to be, so, right, a fermion in a larger number of dimensions has more components, and that's essentially the problem, that when I reduce it to the four-dimensional representations, it'll turn into vector-like or achiral pairs of those objects. I need to be able to get rid of half of them, let's say. So in five dimensions, this is just related to the fact that in five dimensions, the Dirac gamma matrix 5 is actually together with the other gamma matrices to form, you know, just the ordinary set of Lorentz generators, you know, taken together asymmetrically. So five dimensions doesn't have parity. There's no concept of parity. And that's why when I reduce it to four dimensions naively, I end up with a theory that also that respects parity and doesn't allow for the possibility of distinguishing right and left-handed. The way I get around that in the five-dimensional case is to turn, say, the circle into a line segment, and now on the boundaries I can impose boundary conditions that are different. They distinguish between the two-handednesses, and that lets me get rid of them. So that's sort of what you're aiming at, is a source of boundary conditions that lets you get rid of these things. So the KK modes in this theory are labeled by a pair of integers, J and K. They indicate the momentum flow in the two extra dimensions. The masses are given up to the corrections from these boundary terms in terms of J and K as 1 over the size of the box. Obviously, this is actually a square, right? There's only one length here to talk about because I'm identifying the adjacent sides. And the masses are given as J squared plus K squared. One thing that's interesting about this compactification is J and K independently don't have very much meaning, because if I have a particle that I shoot this way, it hits this boundary, and then when it gets to this boundary, it comes out here, but it comes out here going down. So there's actually no sense that this direction is different than this direction. It's really just the sum of the two that makes a difference. So the way the KK parity works is it leaves the lightest of the states that have J plus K equal an odd integer stable, and that provides our stable WIMP. So our WIMP is going to be a state that has one of these guys equal to 1 and the other one equal to 0. That'll be the lightest state that is odd under the parity. However, there are more states, and I'll talk about them in a moment. There are, for example, the states J equal 1, K equal 1. Those are KK even, and that means that they're not dark matter because they decay, but they're still an interesting part of the theory. So the last little piece of extra dimensionology I have to mention is the fact that the vector bosons have KK towers that correspond to both four-dimensional vector particles. So here I have my six-dimensional vector particle, decomposing its, you know, its actual Lorentz index. There's a four-dimensional part of it, which I just identify as a vector. And then there are the cases where it points in the fifth or sixth dimension. Those two degrees of freedom to somebody who lives in four dimensions look like scalar particles. Some combination of them actually gets eaten by the massive vector modes to provide their longitudinal degrees of freedom. But the other combination of them is actually a physical particle. So the upshot is I start with a vector in six dimensions, and I end up with a vector, a tower of vector of massive vectors in four dimensions, and then plus a tower of scalar particles as well. So the boundary terms modify the masses at a given j, k, right? So it, at the lowest level, we had the mass equal proportional to j squared plus k squared, and that means that all the fields that have j and k equal, that have the same j and k, will have the same mass. The boundary terms split apart these a little bit, so that's been done here by putting in some ansatz for what those boundary terms look like. So the result is for these 1-0 modes that the states that have the weakest coupling, so this includes, so I should tell you something about what these mean. The plot didn't come out very well. These three are vector particles, so this is the KK mode of the gluon, the W bosons, and the hypercharge boson. These particles that have the H's are those scalar components that came about when I put my vector particle in extra dimensions. So that's GH is a color octet scalar, and I have an electroweak triplet scalar and a completely inert scalar. And then I also have the fermions that are over here, the leptons and the quarks. What's happened is that by assuming the boundary terms are generated by loops of the bulk physics, the boundary terms are biggest for the colored particles, and so the colored particles become the heaviest elements of the system. Then the SU2 interacting particles, you know, sort of have masses in the middle, and the lightest particles are the one that only have the U1 or the hypercharge interaction. So that's a complicated way of arguing that it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect that the lightest Kaluza-Kleinod particle, or LKP, the thing that's going to be the WIMP, is actually the scalar 1-0 mode of the hypercharge cage boson. And so that tells me that the WIMP is actually a real scalar that's neutral under all of the gauge transformations. The colored states are the heaviest. And now moving down, I can do the same thing. So this was assuming the size of the extra dimension was 1 over the size was 500 GeV. So doing the same thing for the 1-1 modes, we expect them to be roughly square root of 2 times as heavy as the 1-0 modes. And that trend is, in fact, true. They also get spread apart by the boundary modes. And again, the colored particles are the heaviest, SU2 interacting ones in the middle, and the hypercharge interacting particles are the lightest. And what's interesting is that because these things are overall just square root of 2 times as heavy as the WIMP, so if the WIMP mass is here about 425 GeV for this choice of the size of the extra dimension, then we see that actually twice that, or 850 GeV, is enough energy that some of these 1-1 modes are lighter than it. And this is what gives me more lines for my WIMP forest. The WIMP can now annihilate into a photon plus any of these states that are within reach. And that's why this theory is interesting from this point of view. And I think this slide is pretty much just saying what I just said. It's these 1-1 states that make the chiral square particularly interesting. Masses are roughly square root of 2 times the mass of the lightest one. So MB is just the mass of the WIMP here. And that means processes where the WIMPs annihilate into one of these 1-1 states and a photon are kinematically allowed. Using my formula for the kinematics that tells me the energy of the gamma ray, I see that actually this is going to produce a gamma ray line at half of the WIMP mass instead of at the WIMP mass itself. And this is why I went to a six-dimensional theory, which was much harder to talk about than a five-dimensional theory. But the five-dimensional theory just has a straight tower with even spacing. So that means its next highest states are at about twice the mass of the WIMP. And that's too heavy for me to produce them when WIMPs annihilate. So this theory is actually unique from this point of view, at least among, you know, extra-dimensional theories. These 1-1 states are even under KK parity, and that means that they have small couplings to pairs of standard model fields. This lets me produce them singly if I collide standard model fields together at colliders, or it makes them decay if it makes them decay into a pair of standard model particles if I just leave them alone.
Does that mean is that just the
It's very close to that, actually. It's not exactly that, but it is very close to it, yeah.
It's just a multiplicative
D2. That's right. To see it as a parity, I have to actually go back to the orbifold picture and make the space a little bit bigger, but it is actually a parity if I look at it the right way. Okay, so how do these WIMPs in this theory annihilate? This will tell me both the region of the parameter space that's consistent with the relic density, the idea that the WIMP's a thermal relic, and also the continuum gamma ray spectra are controlled by the tree-level annihilation channels. This WIMP is a real scalar, an electroweak singlet. This means that two WIMPs annihilating into fermions is suppressed by the final state fermion mass. That's just the fact that these guys are real and scalar, and therefore there has to be a chiral flip to produce a pair of fermions if I annihilate in the S wave. Annihilation into weak boson and Higgs pairs are mediated by the Higgs itself. And this was studied by these authors at Fermilab. We have two of these WIMPs. They can go through an S-channel Higgs into a pair of Ws, an S-channel Higgs into a pair of Higgses. There's a few graphs here, and there's a similar graph that lets them go into pairs of Z bosons. So these authors took this rate together. Because of the fact that the Higgs here appears in the S channel, and we haven't seen the Higgs yet, so we don't know what its mass is, the rate for this cross section is actually very sensitive to the interplay between the WIMP mass and the Higgs mass. If the Higgs mass is roughly twice the WIMP mass, then I'll be sitting here on the Higgs resonance, and I'll get a huge enhancement of the rate. So the result is that if I plot things in the plane of the mass of the WIMP and the mass of the Higgs, I get this region that looks sort of like this. And what's happening here is that inside here, I'm too close to the Higgs pole. I have too much cross-section. I deplete the WIMPs by too much, and there's not enough dark matter left in the universe. Outside here, I'm too far away from the pole, and therefore the cross-section is too small, and I'm left with too much dark matter. And then in the blue band, what's happening is I'm sitting sort of right at the right point of the resonance so that I get the right amount of dark matter within the errors, you know, extracted from the global fit, including WMAP and everything else. So the message you take away from this plot is that the relic density sort of favors masses between about 100 and 500 GeV, and the Higgs mass does have to do something to make sure that that actually works out. I myself am showing this because it's an interesting take on the parameter space, but for all I know, the WIMP could be a non-thermal relic. I mean, I'm not subscribing particularly to this view. I just want to look at the phenomenology when these things annihilate. So how they actually got there in the universe in the rate that we see is not really what concerns me today. There are collider bounds, and they require that this mass be greater than about 200 GeV, though there are ways to get around that.
This is also a consistent picture in the sense that people have done electric precision fits.
Yes.
Extra content, and these can be that heavy.
That's correct. In fact, actually, if you want to get down to the lower range of these masses, the Higgs had actually, so the lower range is down around here, the Higgs had actually better be this heavier. The precision electroweak doesn't work out right. Because you have Kluze-Klein modes at the tops that contribute to the T parameter, and then having a heavier Higgs helps you compensate that. Not really. I mean, so this parameter is sort of like the size of the extra dimension, but then there are all these boundary terms that I just said, well, I think they're loop size, so therefore they're not really significant. And it turns out they don't really have much to do with the way the WIMP itself annihilates, but they are very important parameters of the theory if you look at colliders, for example. That's right. As far as the abundance is concerned, these are, you know, not exactly the only parameters, but to a very good approximation. In terms of the annihilations I'm going to talk about, the other parameters creep into a slightly larger degree, but they're still not really important.
That's because just the gauge, is it because the gauge variance is fixing those couplings, essentially?
That's right, yeah.
These are the gauge couplings.
That's right, these are gauge couplings.
So this 200 GeV is the direct search bound?
That's right. So this is the Tevatron. I mean, the Tevatron experiments haven't done searches where they really looked for this theory, but they've done searches that should probably be sensitive to it. You know, even looking for supersymmetry, it sort of very roughly should apply, that search should apply to this theory. And so, you know, that gives you a rough bound that you could imagine. But it's not rigorous in the sense that, you know, if you told me, well, actually it's 215 GeV or 175 GeV, I wouldn't be surprised.
They also looked at RV, so I would worry with all these extra states.
Yes.
Really
So they did look actually at, they looked at the oblique corrections and at R sub b, and a forward backward of the beam. This thing also predicts what the ratios of the annihilations should be into. This shows, as again, as a function of the mass of the WIMP, the fraction of annihilations into W's, Z's, Higgs's, and TT bar, which is probably invisible to you guys. The TT bar is never important except right around the threshold for producing top quarks. Dominantly, things go into WW, and at high energies, we have sort of equal amount between the charged modes, which are W plus W minus, and then the two neutral modes, ZZ and HH. And this is just dictated by the Goldstone equivalence theorem, because I'm going through a Higgs. These annihilation modes are somewhat photon unfriendly. They lead to the continuum of gamma rays. So this is shown here as a function of the energy of the gamma ray divided by the mass of the WIMP. And you can see that even for different choices of the WIMP, I sort of scaled out the most important thing here. And so the curves look very similar. They don't produce many gamma rays, and they produce very low energy ones. And that's just because I'm going to these heavy particles that then have to decay, shower, all that stuff. The gammas that come out at the end of the day are very low energy. Of course, the exciting thing is the lines. So the LKP annihilations can lead to gamma ray lines. And this includes gamma gamma, gamma z, gamma, and then these B1 states. So just because of the of Lorentz invariance of, you know, angular momentum conservation, basically, I should produce a gamma ray and a vector particle. So this is either the hypercharge or the neutral W vector final state. These are produced by loop processes. So we see the WIMPs coming in here, gamma, and something else coming out there. What runs in the loop is anything that carries hypercharge, so it can couple to the WIMP, and electric charge, so it can couple to the photon. In the case of this W state, the internal fields also have to be SU2 charged, obviously. This is just sort of technical details. Going back to this spectrum, right, which makes assumptions about the boundary terms, the mass of this W and B state for, so the size of the extra dimension has been set to 500 GeV. Here's twice the WIMP mass, just so you can see what's possible to annihilate into. And I'm just looking at the vectors. So the masses are sort of 700, 800 GeV. Obviously, this scales with the overall size of the extra dimension. So we compute all of these graphs. There's some technical details, blah, blah, blah. This gives us cross-sections, though, for these lines. So this is plotted as a function of the WIMP mass. We use these minimal boundary terms in order to put in the masses of the KK fermions, which are running around in the loop, and therefore we are sensitive to them to some degree. This gives us these cross-sections as a function of the mass. So the solid line here is the cross-section for two photons. Then we have the cross-section for a photon and a Z boson is the dotted line there. And the dashed line is the cross-section for a photon and one of these 1-1 states. One thing that's interesting already is the fact that this cross-section is about an order of magnitude bigger than the other ones. So not only is this line a new feature at a different energy, but it's also got a lot bigger rate. This seems to be an accidental effect that's related to some partial internal cancellations between the different Feynman graphs that contribute. They reduce the gamma-gamma and gamma-z rates by comparison. I think it's an accident, meaning I can't see any deep reason why it should happen. But it's prevented from happening because of the different structure of the graphs that give me the 1-1 state. So it's a welcome accident. So the Z and the 1-1 state lines have intrinsic spread set by their decay widths. The current generation of experiments, so this includes both the Fermi satellite and the ACTs, have energy resolutions which are much greater. They're sort of on the order of 10% for energies around 100 GeV. This is literally for Fermi. The ACTs don't quite go down that low at this point. As a result, the lines broaden into bumps, and the gamma-gamma and gamma-z lines merge together into a single peak. The two 1-1 modes will similarly end up merged together, but they remain distinct from the other peak that's formed by gamma-gamma and gamma-z together. So just to remind us, we have to think about the profile. The strength of the signal depends on the square of the dark matter density. And of course, especially if we're looking at the center of the galaxy, this thing has a large amount of uncertainty for different profiles that people consider. So for one particular choice, we have the following cartoon of what we might imagine seeing as the gamma ray spectrum. So this is for a WIMP mass of 250 GeV. So it cuts off nicely at 250 GeV. The continuum that we saw before is plotted here, and this is E squared times the flux, as is usually quoted. The continuum is here. Then we have the line. So the 1-1 line is sitting here at roughly the Wimp mass divided by 2. Gamma gamma and gamma z you probably can't see on this plot, but they're very close to each other, and they've merged into a single peak, which is, you know, being spread out by this the energy resolution of Fermi. And similarly for the 1-1 line. So also plotted here is some of the Hess data for the galactic center, and this just shows you what you could imagine the foreground could look like.
So that model is ruled out.
It's...
I don't see the point spread above, but
it's... Yeah, you're saying that this is a bit bigger. So yeah, this model with this choice of distribution, which was actually a very favorable one, is ruled out. For a more canonical NFW, it's not quite ruled out, and we'll see that in just 1 second.
I don't have peaks. What's in between peaks? It's just a continuum of...
Yeah, so this is the cases where the WIMPs are annihilating, say, into WW, ZZ, or Higgs. That gives me this, you know, this smear of energies for gamma rays. And then the lines are the distinct two-body annihilations. So going on to the Fermi line search, Fermi glass to search for lines in the spectrum at energies between 30 GeV and 200 GeV. This is a shape analysis where they basically just do a fit to their background and look for any lines that stick out above it. The search region was defined in a kind of a weird way. It includes regions off of the galactic disk, but it does include the galactic center. And that's because there is supposed to be a lot of dark matter here, so it's a good place for a strong signal. The disk doesn't have quite as much dark matter, but it does have a lot of bright sources, and so they take that out. They did this somehow by optimizing their search. It seems a little hokey to me, but oh well. And then they plot this, they make this very busy plot where they show the limits on the cross-section as a function of the line energy. So if this is just annihilation into gamma-gamma, then the energy is the mass of the WIMP, but if there's a heavier state involved, then I have to actually translate. They put a limit as a function of the line energy, and all these different curves are actually just different WIMP profiles. So from isothermal up here at the top down to anasto is down here at the black ones at the bottom. And that way, the idea is you can choose whichever profile you like best, and that's where their limit is. This shows where the chiral square lives. It's at a point where it's still not quite at NFW. It's a factor of a few away. So I personally wouldn't have expected them to have discovered this theory at this point. But it's close enough, actually, that they probably would relatively soon.
So what beacon of the galactic center did you say?
It's 30 degrees square around the galactic center. So basically the idea is so this is all the high latitude stuff that they've included, and then they also include the center right here.
So I assume there is no boost, I guess.
Well, the boost is implicit in the choice of the profile.
Not on top of that.
No, not on top of that. That's right. So as I just said, this is not quite at a point where they should have discovered things, but it's close enough that in a few years they might. If we do make a discovery, we can imagine that the first observation will probably be the 1-1 line because it was a lot stronger than the gamma-gamma or the gamma-z line. Yeah?
Different profiles there? I'm just not a profile expert. How different are those profiles?
Because
things are varying by order.
Yeah, so this is the problem, right? They all agree nicely sort of where we are. But Fermi's resolution, I think, is sitting somewhere around 1 on this plot. So basically, they can't distinguish.
You mean about parsec?
You know what? This is a different plot than I thought.
What is the angular resolution?
Yeah, the angular resolution is 0.2 degrees, maybe, at these energies. Yeah, no, it's actually it's a little further in. These profiles, they vary widely.
I think it's just about 10 parsec. It's a hundredth of a radian, is this right?
Yes. More or less, yeah.
Or less, yeah.
It's a little less than a little less than
like
that.
Like 100, say, 8 kiloparsec or 10 kiloparsec, let's say. So it's 100 parsecs. So between 10 and 100.
I think it's, yeah, I think the number is closer to 10, but.
Is there any hope to improve this, or is this just
so, yeah, the reason we're in this state of affairs is for two reasons. So first of all, the n-body simulations, in as much as we believe them to begin with, can't resolve those small distances. So they can extrapolate from the bigger distances they can consider, but it's an extrapolation. It doesn't actually have, you know, the simulation isn't telling you anything at such a small scale. Second, you have to argue about the physics that's in the n-body simulations themselves. So they don't have baryons, for example. And depending on who you talk to that's an expert, you can either have them tell you that the presence of baryons will make the signal bigger in the center or it will make it smaller in the center. And I mean, they outline perfectly plausible physical scenarios where this would happen, right? For example, the baryons can collapse together and then pull the dark matter in after them. There's also, right, the supermassive black hole, which undoubtedly does something as well, and it depends on whether it's been, had enough time to vacuum up all the WIMPs around it or whether it's just caused them to concentrate. So I would say that there's a lot of uncertainty here, and I don't see how we're going to make huge progress in the near future. Right? The simulations can get better. We can put some of the effects in them, but I'm still not sure everyone's going to agree that they have everything they need.
You just lose so much in rate going away.
Well, I mean, we had to match what Fermi did. So, you know, that's the calculation we did. Of course, you can imagine looking for lines, and you will lose a lot of rate, but maybe it's not hopeless.
Just on the level of trying to rule out a model with this sort of approach, yeah. I mean, this seems pretty hopeless. Really,
yeah,
ruling... Really, signal one thing, but...
Yeah, I would actually take that attitude. I think that you're looking for a signal, and then you're going to go back and understand it. Whereas trying to rule something out, I'm not sure that anyone would really believe it. And so there are proposals. People say maybe you should look at some kind of annular region, you know, so that you kind of get the fact that I'm closer to the center, so I get an enhancement, but I'm not right at the center where things are really murky. That's been proposed, and they will do it eventually.
Astrophysicists are usually happy with an order of magnitude decision. So they need to push them harder.
Yeah. Turning this around, if we do see a signal, then I think we're going to learn a lot about this very quickly.
Yeah.
So, okay. So as I was saying, you know, you can imagine that the initial observation might be the 1-1 line. Eventually, either you'll see the gamma-gamma and the gamma-z peaks or not. If you don't see them, then you'll probably mistakenly think that the mass of the WIMP is located at the 1-1 line, when in fact it's actually twice that. Of course, it may be that we can't see the gamma-gamma line, and in that case we'll be in this mistaken situation. Also, Fermi can't really measure energies above 300 GeV, and so that means that for the most massive LKPs we considered, the gamma-gamma line just may be completely beyond its reach. If we do understand the full line structure, meaning if we see both the 1-1 line and the gamma-gamma-gamma-z peaks, then actually that tells us a mass scale. It tells us where to look for the 1-1. And this could actually be helpful. At the LHC, we can produce 1-1 states from a QQ bar initial state. The couplings, though, are very, very small. And so this is a really, really narrow Z prime-like object. So it gets produced by a QQ bar initial state and decays into ordinary leptons. If we see the line and know where the mass is, it's actually very easy to see it, meaning the energy resolution at the LHC is on leptons is good enough to actually pick this thing out of the background. However, it's knowing where to look may still be very important because it's so narrow that you really have to work hard to get your energy resolution working right at that energy. So if you just make wide bins, you're never going to see this thing because it'll be swamped by the fact that the bins are too wide and the background is therefore enhanced by too much compared to the signal. So this is cute to me. This tells me that actually, you know, Fermi can say something that the LHC may find interesting.
What experiments have they just go through and do a dial-up check?
This thing is so narrow, its width is like sub-MeV.
But so isn't it just smeared out over the resolution?
Right, but what I'm saying, yeah, so the energy resolution on the leptons actually is not the problem. It's true that you won't see much more than one bin, but right. I mean, the problem is that for them to actually bin everything so finely and not get lost in the noise, it'll take a lot of work on their part. And I can't see them doing it.
Binning is late-stage processing. It'll have it on tape.
So yeah, that's right. I mean, so that's right. This is not something that they need to know ahead of time. It's something they can easily do afterwards. Okay, and then just to wrap up, I'll go through very quickly since I'm pretty much just about out of time. Talk about the second case, the Randall-Sundrum theory of dark matter. Just to remind us what Randall-Sundrum looks like. It's an extra dimension as well. It's got a UV brain. and an IR brain. The Higgs lives on the IR brain to solve the hierarchy problem. The space is strongly warped as they go from UV to IR brain, and that's what solves the hierarchy problem. The usual models of interest have the gauge bosons living in the bulk. The top quarks, at least the right-handed top quark, has to live close to the IR brain because it has to be able to couple to the Higgs and get its large mass. The left-handed top quark may be a little bit more smeared out, but it still can't be too far away. And the light quarks probably live near the UV brain, and that just reduces the constraints on from precision electroweak observables on them. This particular model was proposed by Gachet and Servant. Actually, the model itself wasn't, but the dark matter interpretation of it was. It has SO10, a gut theory in the bulk, and some extra structure that avoid rapid proton decay. So what these authors looked at was the case where part of the SO10 multiplets includes a right-handed neutrino KK mode, and this is the LKP and can actually be a WIMP, meaning that there is actually a funny kind of a KK parity, which in this theory is not at all a parity because the warping means that no point looks like any other point. But there is still actually a symmetry that can let this thing be stable and be dark matter. It's very strong. So yeah, basically what happens is anytime I put a gut symmetry in the bulk of RS, the KK modes pile up at TeV. And so that means there are gut bosons that have masses at the TeV scale. So naively,
the X and Y
bosons, yeah. Yeah, that's not good, right? The proton would probably, we wouldn't be here to have this conversation.
Is
that's right.
Is it enough just to separate quarks from leptons? It's like split from them.
So one thing you can imagine doing, and this is not what was done here, is you could actually try to physically separate them in the extra dimension, and that would suppress them because their wave function overlap would be small. That's right. That's Nima and Martin Schmaltz. What people typically do in these models, because since it's a gut theory, it's very hard, since I have a gut symmetry in the bulk, to actually separate the things that belong to the same gut multiplets, because the gut symmetry demands that they stay at the same point. So what's done instead here is to split the multiplets up. So to use SO10 language, right, my entire fermion generation lives in a 16. But if, let's say, I take each generation and put it in a few 16s such that the quarks and the leptons don't get together in the right ways. And that's what they do here, actually. Honestly, as a gut model, I find it kind of ugly. But it has interesting dark matter phenomenology. So the LKP is like a right-handed neutrino. It has no standard model gauge interactions. It does interact with the neutral Z prime boson that corresponds to one of the broken SO10 generators. The Z prime itself is a KK mode. It interacts strongly with the right-handed top quark because it's the only fermion that lives close to the IR brain. And the couplings of so the KK modes all live near the IR brain. And so any KK modes live close to the IR brain, and therefore they all have strong couplings among each other. And they'll also have strong couplings to the fields of the IR brain, so the right-handed top quark and the Higgs. And then they'll have much weaker couplings to the light fermions. So this Z prime that the WIMP uses to communicate to the rest of the world likes to talk to top quarks, but it doesn't like to talk to any of the light fermions. So as a result, the WIMP likes to annihilate into top quarks through the Z prime. The rest of this is okay, well. The important thing for the WIMPs is that if the WIMP mass is above the top quark mass, then the WIMPs will just annihilate directly into a pair of top quarks, and that'll give me the continuum emission that I expect from a heavy particle. It'll look rather soft. Below the top mass, the continuum is just highly suppressed altogether, and that's because I either have to go through off-shell top quarks, which reduces the rate, or I have to go through the fact that the Z prime has a very, very tiny mixing with the Z boson, and that lets me actually get to the light fermions or the Ws or the Z. Oh, actually, this graph is showing that if the Z prime itself is light enough, the WIMPs may annihilate into pairs of Z primes. That's not suppressed, but it doesn't give me a very strong continuum emission either. Okay, so here it is. These are the different channels for the WIMP mass set to 180 GeV. They all look fairly similar to each other. What's interesting here, though, is that we can have annihilations through loops. And since the Z prime couples very strongly to the top quark, the main thing that goes into the loop is the top quark itself. This can lead to a gamma Z, gamma Higgs, since the top quark is massive and also couples to the Higgs boson. And if the Z prime is light enough, a gamma Z prime final state. So there's actually a bunch of lines I could imagine getting here corresponding to gamma Z gamma Higgs, and gamma Z prime. The gamma-gamma state itself is actually forbidden in this theory by the Landau-Yang theorem, because I have to go through a vector particle here. And the cute thing is that we produce the Higgs boson in space. So WIMPs annihilating actually produce a fair amount of Higgs bosons. And it's interesting to trace back why the possibility of a Higgs gamma ray line actually showed up in this theory and not in other theories. The main thing was that, just looking at angular momentum conservation, if we want our WIMPs to be able to annihilate to produce a vector and a scalar through an S-wave process, one that's not suppressed by their very small velocities, they have to have a net spin of 1, since I'm not allowed to have any orbital angular momentum involved. If I had Majorana fermions, I can't be in spin 1 because their particle is its own antiparticle. And therefore, the spin 1 state is where the spins are aligned, but non-relativistically, that's excluded by Fermi-Dirac statistics. A Dirac particle, though, I can imagine colliding the particle and the antiparticle. There's no problem having a net spin 1, and therefore this process goes through. So having actually a Higgs gamma ray line is something that's somewhat special. It's not just any theory that does it. So we computed all these graphs and their cousins. This is, again, the cross-section as a function of the mass of the WIMP. The Z prime mass in these examples was set equal to 220 GeV. So we see that all the rates get enhanced when the WIMP mass is equal to 110, because then this thing, again, gets close to a resonance. And we can see that that resonant region is actually excluded by Fermi itself. So Fermi's gamma ray line search sort of excludes cross-sections down to about 10 to the minus 26 for this range of masses. And we can exclude this sort of corner of parameter space. But of course, there's plenty of parameter space where we're not living right on the resonance that would still work.
What is that edge?
This edge here?
Yeah.
This is the top quarks turning on. It's not fair to call this bounded because this is a line search and the top quarks produce a continuum of gamma rays. But you can see that the annihilation does, you know, get very big once I get heavy enough to go into top quarks.
Can you say
again about the Landau-Yang theorem? Yeah. As proven by Landau and Yang, independently, I believe, it says that the rho meson, so a massive vector particle from QCD in that case, can't decay into two photons. And all it relies on is parity in charge conjugation invariance of the electromagnetic interaction. So in this case, you know, we don't have a rho meson. So you can use the same theorem to say that the Z boson cannot decay into two photons. And that's, again, because all it really assumed was that your initial state was a vector particle. That's right. So and that the electromagnetic interactions conserve parity in charge conjugation invariance. But, I mean, they do. What that tells you is that actually any neutral vector particle cannot decay into two photons, because it's just the quantum numbers that mattered, actually. And also, anything that goes through such a particle can also not. So putting that together, for very favorable parameters, you could actually imagine even resolving three lines. So that's the gamma Z line, gamma Higgs, and the gamma Z prime. So you could imagine seeing spectra. So here's the continuum emission here. This is just for different choices of the rho squared, of the density of the WIMPs. And then also shown here is that same Hess data as a foreground, and also the EGRIT and the Fermi measurements. But these are continuum measurements. They're not the line searches. The line searches are still not actually quite sensitive to this cross-section yet. That would be very cute. You could imagine seeing multiple lines. But, of course, all you really see are a bunch of gamma ray lines. You would need then to turn those over to colliders and understand what the actual states that they correspond to are. So it was asked before, and also mentioned today, what happens when Higgses are produced in space and travel backward in time? I think Holger Nielsen would want to know the answer to this question. I could turn this around to Holger and ask him, if the Higgs is really so toxic to the LHC, what about all the ones that are being produced in the upper atmosphere? Because they are being produced.
I didn't know that.
Well, I don't, but then...
You don't need that,
fair enough. They're hard to collect and measure their mass. Hard to collect and weigh. It may be they go back in time and influence 1970s television. So here is the pigs in space connection. And this image, which was found by one of my collaborators, actually even has interesting references to the LHC, perhaps, and the swine flu. All right, so that aside, to finish up, WIMP annihilation of the gamma rays are interesting. They're an important way to search for WIMPs and their interactions non-gravitationally. and to learn something about them, especially in tandem with collider signals. And hopefully this gamma ray forest idea sort of illustrates how that can work very well. There's been a lot of attention to the annihilation into gamma-gamma and gamma-z modes, but there may be more particles in what I'll call, quote-unquote, the dark sector, which can be produced as well in the annihilations, and they may result in distinctly observable lines. So there may actually be something we can learn about the theory that's... We can learn about particles that may not be around in the universe today by watching the WIMPs annihilate through them. And so some of the examples we saw were the mass of a super-weakly coupled Z-prime, or maybe an indirect view of the Higgs boson, which can have a big interplay with what the LHC sees. So I looked at the rates expected in two different extra-dimensional theories of dark matter, but hopefully it's clear this phenomenon is really just kinematics. It doesn't have anything to do with the extra dimensions. It just tells you something about where I like to do my research. The phenomenon is general, and any time there is a state that we can annihilate into, in addition to a photon, we can actually get these extra lines. So it can actually happen in many models of dark matter. So thank you for listening.
So
that's right. Correct.
Which means that it's not only the proton decay. I mean, the question I have is that I'm not sure if you can make it work because it's not only the proton decay. You have neutron and the neutron oscillation. You have
Yeah.
changing neutron currents. You have mixing between neutrinos. If you don't want to separate the, if you don't want to apply that geography in extra dimensions and separate
Yeah.
all of the fusions, then I just don't see how can you play with the multiplets and solve all the problems.
So actually, I would say the geography has been invoked in a way that addresses most of the concerns you just voiced. And what was done is most of it was solved by putting the light fermions on the UV brain, right? Because it's true that there are operators that undoubtedly violate all of those accidental symmetries you mentioned that live on the IR brain, and they're characterized by a few TeV. So they're extremely dangerous. But when I put in the wave functions of the light quarks, which have very, very little support over here, they are effectively suppressed by the UV scale or by the Planck scale. I mean, the real Planck scale, right? The four-dimensional Planck scale. So as a result, I don't worry so much about those things. The worry about proton decay was because I put gut physics into the bulk. And if I put it in the bulk, I can't hide from it by just being over on this side, right? I have to live with the fact that it lives everywhere, and I don't get the suppression of the wave function.
Either you have a thick brain or
many brains. There are different ways you can imagine doing it. So, right, the simplest thing is if you're worried about protons decaying into electrons, right, take your electron and take your light quarks and just separate them in the extra dimension. So that the bulk physics can let them decay, but they can't find each other to do it, basically.
So, effectively, you get some higher dimension operator that has an extremely small coefficient.
That's right. So let's say the size of the extra dimension is TeV, right? So then 1 over TeV is the scale of the physics, but it effectively seems like a much higher scale because of the wave function suppression. And some of that, that doesn't really work this way. This works because, you know, the concern is that the 1 over TeV physics only lives on this end of the extra dimension. So I don't actually have to separate the quarks apart from the leptons. All I have to do is separate them apart from the operators that let them decay. Right, which are 1 over TeV over here, but they're 1 over M Planck here. And so that's really how that argument works.
Any more questions?
So what is the energy resolution of Fermi?
So it varies a lot as a function of energy, but for the sort of greater than GeV energies, it's something like 10%. And it's 10% roughly from about a GeV up to about 300 GeV. And then beyond that point, they don't get enough. So beyond that point, the particles go through the detector and they don't stop sufficiently. They don't deposit enough energy. And it becomes effectively 100% very quickly after that.
So the other question I have is the Sommerfeld enhancement, is that something that could be put in this or not really?
It doesn't naturally happen here. I don't have any light force carriers that would mediate it. Of course, you could always add more baggage if you wanted it, but I mean, I was happy with things the way they were already.
So I guess what I'm wondering is that why just galactic center, the whole universe has gamma rays? There are probably much more mass in the universe than there is in galactic center. So you can just look at the entire background of the
Yeah. So this is a search that they do. it's not actually competitive, even with even taking into account how murky our understanding of the galactic center is. It's not competitive just because the density of WIMPs is smaller out there.
Well, but the large boost that I guess you're ignoring, the factors of
Hans-Kettle. The large boost, you mean coming from a Sommerfeld enhancement?
No, from substructure.
Yes, that's true. I think it's hard to get a boost of 100. It's
well,
easily.
That's when the simulations came.
Well, so,
of course, they do extrapolation because they cannot resolve like that.
That's right. So I may just talk to the wrong structure formation people, but they told me sort of factors more like 10 are what they expect.
Well, within the galactic center, or within the solar radius, it's small, but if you go all the way out to the radius, it could be huge.
Okay. I mean, so one of the searches that Fermi does do is to look for dark subhalos. That's right. So these are things that don't have any counterpart in other wavelengths where WIMPs are presumably annihilating and giving you gamma rays. That would fall into, the idea, right? They're looking for a specific region that would be a specific example of one of these clumps.
How fast do these WIMP particles move
with the galaxies? So I guess, if you're asking about what we really firmly understand, I think we have no idea is the real answer. It's not thought that they're moving very fast, though. They're probably highly non-relativistic.
But the rotation velocity, you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So
still highly non-relativistic.
Yeah.
Who's there to start the rhythm of the galaxy?
Yeah, so if they go faster than, say, 600, 700, 800, then they will not be bound. Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank them again.